I remember the rumbling. It felt like a freight train.
And it goes on for a while, maybe 15.
A tornado tore through our small town like a giant weed whacker.
And all of a sudden, somebody in the back says, there's a flame coming out of engine number 3. Something you don't want to hear as you break into the eyewall.
This is Design Safe Radio, where natural hazards researchers strive to make our society more resilient to everything nature throws at us.
Thanks for being with us today on the 20th episode of Design Safe Radio, the show that talks about everything nature has to throw at us and how scientists are working to make our society more resilient. We're now featured on the NSF Science 360 Radio. Science 360 Radio is where you can go for great podcasts sponsored by the National Science Foundation. From Science Friday to the Discovery Files, it's all there. Check it out at science360.gov/radio. I'm your host, Dan Zahner, from the Natural Hazards Engineering Research Infrastructure Network Coordination Office at Purdue University, and this is Design Safe Radio. Today on the show, we continue our conversation with the legendary Dr. Frank Marks from NOAA's Hurricane Research Division. Enjoy the show. So, you've been at the Hurricane Research Lab now, the Hurricane Research Division and the National Hurricane Center, for 37 years. What are some of the highlights from your time there? You've been through a ton of amazing storms, have pioneered different techniques and measurement. Can you give us some of your favorite moments?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. When I came here, I was a radar meteorologist. I had worked with ship radars. I'd worked with aircraft. I just started dabbling with aircraft radars before I graduated because I'd been in Borneo for a month in an experiment called the Winter Monsoon Experiment. And they were flying the P3, NOAA P3s, which I work with all the time, which have radars on board, near a radar I was at manning on the north coast of Borneo. And so we were comparing what we saw on the north coast of Borneo radar to the P3 radar whenever they flew. And that's got me experience with the P3s. And when I came here, to Miami, my job was to work with the P3 radars and to make them useful tools. And we have two wonderful radar systems on the P3s. One is in the belly of the plane we call the lower fuselage radar. And that gives us a plan view, kind of like the WSR-88Ds do for the land-based radars, out to 200 miles away from the aircraft.
So that gives you the overhead view of the storm.
Yeah, that's my situation awareness. And then the real dynamic tool is in the tail of the aircraft. We have a Doppler radar that spins vertically. And we have, well, now we have two antennas mounted back to back that look 20 degrees forward and 20 degrees aft. So we can do a complete volume scan as we fly through the storm.
Oh, wow.
And have that analysis on the ground within a half hour. But back in the day, when I first started, we didn't have Doppler. We had just the reflectivity, and I've got to fly in Hurricane Allen, my first flight. Allen was a Cat 5 storm. It was not a Cat 5 as we entered it the first day, but it became a Cat 5 2 days later. And it was moving across the Caribbean. At the time, we were flying just south of Puerto Rico and Hispaniola, and then all the way through to Texas. And what an experience that was to be flying in a hurricane. I mean, you're apprehensive the first time you do it, but boy, it's as a scientist, you know, and with my experience with radar, seeing all these different things on the plane was just like, holy moly, what is going on here? This is amazing.
Yeah.
I became hooked. It was, you know, incredible flying 3 or 4 days out of the storm, 7 day lifetime, in and out of it, and seeing the variability and the changes. I mean, that was the first time we ever saw an eyewall replacement cycle. We hadn't even documented it yet. It was kind of in the back of Hugh Willoughby's mind and mine. And so we published a number of papers. I published a paper showing how the radar structure changed as the eyewall replacement cycle went on. And you know, there was a lot of discussion, was it caused by land, was it a natural process? Because in those days, NOAA was still thinking about tropical storm modification through the project called Storm Fury.
Really?
And the hypothesis of Storm Fury was to seed clouds outside the eye wall and form a second eye wall, which would then choke off the inner one and weaken the storm, you know, a certain percentage, which would mitigate some of the damage. But what had happened was, you know, they'd done a couple experiments and they saw that might work. But then this whole eye wall replacement cycle came about that we were discovering, which pretty much wiped out the whole storm theory hypothesis, because the storms are doing what they were trying to do naturally.
Right. So it's already collapsing the eye and reforming it, and it's stronger than ever.
Right. And I mean, if people watched Irma this past summer, they would have seen that Irma did that at least three or four times before in Florida.
And Alan did that a couple of times, right? Became a Cat 5 three times or something.
So here we are again, serendipity, like my diurnal rainfall thing. Here I am looking with Hugh Willoughby at this whole idea of eye roll replacement cycle. I mean, Hugh wrote the papers looking at the wind. I did it on the radar. And it was just like, you know, serendipity again, holy crow, you know. And then the next big thing for me was the Doppler. In 1981, we Dopplerized the tail antenna, and that was a whole new technology. My colleague Dave Jorgensen and I were working together and trying to get the measurements so we could see what we could see. And that then took off again. You know, the first papers published on Doppler radar and hurricanes I did with Bob House. You know, and for me, it became a new tool. And it was able to, you know, use that to look at the hurricane structure and understand things like asymmetries and three-dimensional structure. Up until that time, the only way we got wind structure was by flying stacked airplanes or doing multiple legs across the storm at different altitudes and trying to piece it together. Some of the classic papers from the storm theory days and from the beginning of the National Hurricane Research Project, all they had was aircraft flight level data. And then when we started the Doppler, you know, it would take months to get an analysis out. Nowadays, we do it on the fly on the aircraft. I don't even have to be on the airplane to do it. We can do it from the ground. What's the difference between
Doppler radar and reflectivity radar?
The difference is that I can get a measure of the motion of the precipitation particles towards or away from the radar. And so having
so
that
it's not just the position, it's their change in position.
Correct, which is an estimate of the wind, because that's the only way they're moving is through the wind and gravity, of course, for the vertical component. But when you're looking horizontally, it's pretty much all wind motion. Hmm. So by flying this Doppler radar through it, we're doing essentially a CAT scan of the wind as well as the precipitation. And so you can get the vertical profile, so you can get the vertical velocity profile through the storm.
Oh, wow.
You're on, and you can get three-dimensional winds all the way around out to 50 miles away from the radar. So by doing repeated legs, we get complete 3D mappings of the storm structure. Part of my career in the 80s was just publishing paper after paper on what we were seeing with these Doppler radars. And it was just incredible. It was a revolution in our ideas and thinking about vortex in shear, vortex in a three-dimensional environment, and how those asymmetries evolved as a storm changed and evolved. It brought out more than just eye wall replacement cycles. It brought out how a storm changes as the environment around it changes. And so it was a great ride, and probably some of the best interactions and collaborations I ever had as a scientist. Going through that phase, it was just incredible. People you work with, the young students that come along and become your colleagues, it's just an incredible experience. And then, of course, the biggie for me was Hurricane Hugo. 1989, September 15th. I can probably tell you the minute and hour. We were in Barbados. When we fly the P-3s, we don't only fly from the U.S. We can reposition the planes at a forward base like St. Croix or San Juan, Puerto Rico, for a number of years we did, and Barbados or Bermuda to get to the storms earlier and to get, you know, more structural, more time in the storms as they evolve. So we were flying in Hurricane Hugo when we took off this 1989. So again, you know.
And was this the one where you were flying with Jeff Masters?
Correct. Jeff Masters was our flight director. Jeff is now the head of Wonderground. Jeff was our flight meteorologist. I was the lead scientist. And the plan for the mission was one plane go into the core and map the core out of the inner structure of the storm, the inner 100 kilometers or so. And then the other plane was doing drop sons around the periphery to look at the environment so we could piece the whole 3D structure together. And so we went in. We had been doing this, trying to do this experiment for about 2 years. And we had just done it or tried to do it 10 days before this mission started when we had a fuel leak and we had a, you know, break off the pattern and one plane had to go home and the other plane continued. But we didn't get the experiment done. So we were determined to get this experiment done, but we made some what I would call tactical errors. You got to realize that, you know, you do this business and you think you know what you're talking about, but Mother Nature always has a way to remind you that, no, you don't know what you're talking about.
Reminds you who in charge.
Right. So we took off and the plan was we were going to go low altitude, 500 meters, 1500 feet into the storm. When we took off, we thought it was a Cat 2. Now, Cat 2s at 1500 feet, well, they're bumpy, but, you know, they're doable. And the only tactical error was that pattern was supposed to be at the end of the mission after we had already reconnoitered the storm to make sure that it was safe to do it. But we decided to put it at the front because we wanted to make sure it got done before.
So you would fly higher to see what category the storm actually was before doing a lower flight.
Right. So we're approaching Hugo from the southwest. And it turned out, you know, the storm was a Cat 5 and had been deepening for 6 hours, but we didn't know it.
Wow.
At about 2 millibars or hectopascals an hour, which is quite rapid. And the wind speeds that were ramping up to 150 miles an hour, 160 miles an hour. And so we're approaching the storm and I'm looking at it on radar and I'm saying, geez, this is a lot better organized storm than we think. It had a nice small eye about 10 or 12 miles across and very intense rain. And then, you know, Murphy hits us. We lose the radar and we have to stop and circle and fix the radar, get the radar back up, continue our pattern of 500 meters. And we're approaching the storm and I'm looking at it and I'm saying, geez, this looks like it's going to be a rough one. So I said to the pilots, as we're starting to enter the turbulent area, I said, you know, we can climb if you want to. He said, oh, no, we're okay. We'll ride this out. Lo and behold, we hit the most intense part of the eye wall. We hit 3 updrafts above 10 meters per second, separated by 2 downdrafts separate below down 10 meters per second. And each one of the updrafts got stronger, and this is all within 30 seconds. And so we hit the storm center, we hit the eye wall center, and all of a sudden somebody in the back says, there's a flame coming out of engine number 3.
Oh, man.
Something you don't want to hear as you break into the eye wall.
Yeah.
The flight engineer, we have 3 people who control the aircraft when you're flying. I'm the scientist. I'm sitting behind the lead pilot on the left. There's a co-pilot on the right and a flight engineer in the middle. Each one has a job. The flight engineer's job is to keep the turbines moving at the same rotation and to watch the temperatures on the engines. The right pilot, his job is to communicate, and the left pilot's job is to make sure the wings are level. When you're in turbulence, you don't want to move too much. You want to let the turbulence push you because it's not going to push you that far. I mean, even at 500 meters, you're probably not going to go down more than 100 meters by a downdraft in the eye.
Yeah, and if you're which sounds like correct, a lot, then you could go down a bit more, and that would be bad.
Yeah. Well, people on commercial airliners don't know what turbulence is. I'll tell you that. But,
yeah,
I can tell you that the pilot on the left that I was sitting behind had a Diet Coke can, and the three updrafts, as we came out of each one of them, I caught the Coke can in the air.
Goodness. The somebody was asking me as I was getting ready for this interview, do you have barf bags on the P3 Orion?
Well, the Coke can didn't end up where it should have. Let's put it that way. On the last bump, I didn't quite catch it. But, you know, so we had to shut down that engine. And then here we are in this magnificent, I can say that now, incredible eye that was just like a, you know, a giant stadium that Jeff Masters has a ton of pictures of, by the way. That was just incredible. But nobody was looking at it. All we were looking at was the sea below us and trying to decide what to do next.
And making sure that it stays below you.
Yeah, and everybody's freaking out, as you can imagine. But up in the cockpit, we were calm. And we saw that if we stayed on our path, we were going to go right back in the eye wall. So we had to turn to the right, which meant we had to turn into the bad engine, or the engine that was not there, which meant we were going to lose lift. We knew that, but we had to turn that way, and we had to do a loop and then go the other way. So in the middle of that, we did descend down to about 1,200 feet, which, some people were really nervous about that. We're descending. And I said, hey, listen, this is a controlled descent. We know what we're doing.
Yeah.
And then we circled in the eye for an hour, slowly climbing up to about 2,500 feet or 3,000 feet. And then the Air Force plane came in. They came by, looked at us, made sure nothing was broken. Our other P3 broke off their pattern, came in, and they escorted us out of the eye. But that was the only time we've had discussions about what happens if we have to ditch a P3 in a hurricane.
What would have happened if you had had to ditch?
Yeah. Well, not much. There's only been a couple successful ditches of P3s. Let's put it that way.
I'm glad we didn't have to do that.
Yeah. They're pretty rugged aircraft. So, I mean, I wasn't nervous about that. The only thing I would say is later I had this thought as we were landing that, darn it, we didn't turn the instruments back on after we were out of the truck. You know, but I will say the data that we got from that mission was incredible. It was probably the only example of a Cat 5 penetration with, you know, over 80 meter per second winds and, you know, 23 meter per second updrafts that we have on record.
Wow.
And the analysis of that was a labor of love that, you know, I was so happy when we finally got it published. It took some time because we had a number of things happen in between that. Andrew hit us in 92, and a lot of the work that we had done got lost. We had to find it. We had to reconstruct it.
Oh, wow.
But we finally got
Andrew too, right?
Yeah, we finally got the paper out, and I think it's been fuel for a lot of things, like improving the H-Wharf model and all sorts of things, because those type of data are priceless. You can't get them. You know, nobody does that. On purpose.
Yeah, nobody's crazy enough to fly that low through a Cat 5 anymore.
Well, not, you know, now we try different ways to do it. We got, you know, how do they say, you know, experience makes good decisions, but you got to make mistakes to get experience. Well,
right.
My experience is based on those mistakes. So that's one of my best stories, I think. But I have a lot of them.
We talked for a while about those before. Man, we're going to have you back because you've just got a wealth of amazing stories. You were talking about some of the other developments after Bob Burpee left and you started heading up the field program. Can you talk about some of the other developments in rainfall climatology after you took over?
Yeah, well, like I said, I am always intrigued by opportunity. After 92, I was involved in Toga Corps in 92. After Andrew hit, we went off to, I was in Guadalcanal, actually, during the 50th anniversary of the battle there.
No kidding.
Yeah, that was incredible to see foxholes that were still there that were 4 feet deep instead of 6 feet deep. But that, wow. that was incredible. But after the Toga Corps, I came back and took over the field program. And during Toga Corps, we had worked with NASA. And they were interested in tropical cyclone missions because they had a plan to put up an experiment called the Tropical Rain Measurement Mission, or TRIM. And so when we were in Toga Corps, I suggested to the NASA program managers that they contact me after the season, after Toga Corps, they wanted to do hurricane work, and they did. In 1997, around this time of year, they launched the TRIM satellite. And in 98, we had a major field program on hurricanes with NASA participation, with the goal to get some data to calibrate the TRIM satellite. You know, they wanted to fly in hurricanes because that's a hurricane provides it for the atmosphere, pretty much the whole spectrum from, you know, the blue sky, nice light wind, all the way into the worst you can imagine as you go into the core. And it's pretty compact. You can use an aircraft and sample it great. And you get a lot of information about the variability of precip in particular, which is what TRIM was after. And so after that experiment, I was going out and giving talks about this. NASA invited me to give a number of talks on what we saw in the aircraft. And the first one I went to was in Paris. These were TRIM meetings, meetings to review what TRIM had seen. And I went to this meeting in Paris, and they start showing images from TRIM. Then the first thing I see is a tropical cyclone, a hurricane. I said, huh, TRIM sees hurricanes. That looks pretty good. And so then another speaker got up and gave his talk, and I said, oh, must be the same storm. No, it's not. It's another one. And there were like five or six talks of, and they were kept showing hurricanes. And I kept saying, oh my God, here's a tool that looks at hurricanes globally a lot. So I ended up going to give a seminar up at NASA Goddard about a month later. And I gave my talk, and after the talk, I went to see the TRIM chief scientist, who was at that time Dr. Joanne Simpson, who was quite a lady who I had first met in Gate. She was incredible, one of the first women PhDs in meteorology. She'd done incredible work. She was a pioneer in our field. And so I went to see her, and you know, she was a friend, and she's always enthusiastic. And I walked into her office. She invited me up, and I said, Joanne, you know, at these TRIM meetings, I'm seeing a lot of hurricanes in the TRIM. She said, oh, yeah, we see a lot of hurricanes. And I said, is anybody looking at them? She said, no, we need somebody to do that. I said, well, I have a, you know, I'm affiliated with the University of Miami. If I could get a grad student, would you be interested in us looking at the hurricane? Oh, no, definitely do that. And she said, I can't give you money right now. You have to write a proposal, but I can promise you $30K if you can get me a student. So I said, okay. And I went back to Miami. I ran into my colleague, Shui Chen, and I said, you know, I can get $30K for a student to work with TRIM if you're interested. She said, sure. And so we went through a couple applicants, and we found this young man, Manuel Lanfot, who was great. And we brought him on to study the TRIM data. We wrote the proposal. We got a full proposal funded for more than the $30K. And so that led to us using TRIM to derive a global climatology of tropical cyclone rainfall, because wow. We saw, you know, hundreds of tropical cyclones every year. And so over the first 3 years, we saw 700 tropical systems, of which, you know, 250 were hurricanes, and
whoa.
I think 100 were major hurricanes. And so we started developing this rainfall climatology, just that's still the best climatology I know of tropical cyclone rainfall. And Manuel, you know, got his PhD doing that stuff. It was incredible. You know, just serendipity again, walking into somebody's office and saying, hey, anybody looking at this?
Yeah. Just having that curiosity and be like,
yeah,
are we going to do something with this?
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
And that led to another kind of serendipitous technology when, you know, you started working with TAC and their supercomputing center down there at University of Texas as well a few years later.
Oh, That's another goodie. That's a great story.
For those of you who don't know, TAC is part of a NARI research network, so we work with them a lot.
Yeah, so this is 2008, where we've had the 2005, 4 and 5 hurricane seasons with the Ritas and the Katrinas and the Wilmas and the Frans and the Jeans and, all these big storms. And so NOAA had a Blue Ribbon committee put together to try and recommend things for NOAA that we could do to improve our forecasting. And so out of that came, which I staffed that committee, and then out of that came a desire to put a plan together to address the recommendations, which became the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Project, which I was a science lead for. And I worked with an operational partner, Asha Tribble, who was at the Hurricane Center at the time. And we put this plan together. We had a brief at the NOAA, and NOAA accepted it, but we didn't have a budget. We were in like the budget cycle 2010. So the 2008 season's coming along, and my project manager, who's managing the project, Fred Tepfer, calls me up and says, listen, the NOAA CIO was at a meeting with the NSF Chief Information Officer, NOAA's Chief Information Officer, and they were talking about our computing needs for this hurricane project. We were trying to build up our computing infrastructure to do stuff.
Yeah.
And so he said, they have this new complex coming up in Texas called the Texas Air Advanced Computer Complex, TAC. And they have a brand new computer coming online at NSF, and they're doing testing of it online before they open it up to everybody. And so for the next 3.5 months, they're willing to give us 1 million hours of computer time to try out some of our ideas for HVIP. And I said, oh, wow. He said, yeah, can you put me something together on that? I said, okay. Well, a colleague of mine, Fuching Zhang, who's now a professor at Penn State, was moving from Texas A&M to Penn State, and he was going to spend a month sabbatical at HRD.
Hmm.
And Fuching is a data simulation person. He had worked with me on the simulation to look to improve hurricane forecasting from ground-based radars. And so Fuching was coming to talk to us about how we could do that with the aircraft. Well, Fuching walked in, I think, for his 1 month stay about the day after I heard from Fred Tepfer about this computer. So I said to Fuching, I said, hey, Fuching, if I can get you 1 million computer hours on this Texas computer, what would you do with it? And so Fuching said, we could do this, we could do that, we can run a lot of ensembles. And I said, that's great. So I sent Fred an email, this is what we think we can do. And Fred said, that's great, good, good, good. About a week later, Fred came back and said, well, can you do anything to make the operational model better? Can we do this in the model and actually show impact? So I went back to Fuching. I said, what do you think, Fuching? Can we do something this summer and show them that? He said, oh, yeah, we can do that. So we start making plans to do that. The TAC computer had the model on it already. We just had to get the data to it. And so then Fred comes back and says, can you do it now? This is like we're in the beginning of the season. I think Tropical Storm Fay was coming along, and we hadn't had Gustav Reich yet. And so we said, okay. I said to Fuching, what do you think? Can we do it now? He said, well, this will be a stretch. But, he in the meantime was working with my colleague, John Gamache, about how to convert his code to generate the obs that we needed for the model to assimilate from the Doppler radar on the plane. And so they generated the code to get the data on the plane into some format that we could send it to the model. But of course, the only way we could send it to the model was a satellite communication system that was only at about 400 baud. Not even a 1200 or 2400 baud modem yet.
Oh, wow.
So we had to compress the data down, obviously. And so we tried this the first time in Tropical Storm Fay, and actually it worked. We were able to do it in real time. And we were just like blown away. We were so ecstatic. And then the week later, Hurricane Gustav came along. and so it was like a one-armed paper hanger. John was on the ground, and I was on the airplane, and Fuching was at Penn State working on the computer model with his colleague. And, it's just like we're all doing our thing. And if anybody doesn't get their job done, nothing's going to happen. And so we tried it in real time in Gustav, and it actually worked. The forecasts were coming a little late, but it actually worked. And we were ecstatic. And then Ike came, and Ike was like, holy moly, this thing is a monster going across the Gulf straight to Texas. You know, and we'd been working with the Texas Advanced Computer Center, and they were just ecstatic that this was going on, because they were saying, look at what we can do, and, you know, justifying their existence and stuff.
Yeah.
And then comes Ike straight at Texas. Talk about serendipity.
Yeah.
I mean, to this day, Fuching has carte blanche on tap because of what we did. He can run anything he wants on that computer system because we made that famous. But it was funny, talk about one-armed paper hangers, the data had to go through this circuitous route to get it to the computer center. You got these, 20,000 processor machine running these jobs, tremendous compute power, and you're feeding it through the straw of data. Little trickles of data are going into this monstrous compute complex. I had these, Rube Goldberg in mind when I'm thinking about how we made all this work. But again, serendipity, Fuching walks in at the right time and he has an idea and you take off and run with it, and you can do incredible things.
And that data now feeds into the EdCirc models for storm surge forecasting too as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, now we do it all the time now. Fuching was the first to do it. He gets credit for that, but boy, now that's the only way we do it. That's why you're seeing, that's what's driving the improvement in the forecast right now, is getting the data into the models, using it properly. And I give Fuching full credit for pioneering that and showing us how it could be done, and having the spirit and the willingness to just dive in with us and swim as fast as we could.
That's the key. Like you were saying before, it's all about just that hard work and curiosity and making the most of the opportunities you've got.
Yeah. And what I would say is I've been blessed to meet people, to have mentors, to be encouraged to take risk and to be willing to fail so that I could learn and get experience and be able to, tell people that that's the way you should work, that, this is science is a joy when you work that way. It's not, looking at numbers and looking at equations and solving problems. It's actually doing stuff and experiencing it all. I give a tribute to Jim Witt for inspiring me, for showing me that joy that I could share with others.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today and inspiring us. I mean, the couple of times we've gotten to talk, I've been extremely inspired by your enthusiasm and your just passion for science as a whole and for meteorology. It's just infectious.
Well, I'm glad, because that's the way I feel about it. I try and impart that to my staff all the time. And, one of the things I would say that's critical in this is, and I think Jim Witt and all my other mentors allowed me to do this, is to make it safe to question.
Mm.
You want to have an environment where questioning and taking risks is in a safe situation, that you're not feeling that your career is dependent on it or your success is dependent on not taking a risk. You want to be in a situation where you feel like you're safe to take the risk. And that's a challenge for a lot of management and leadership, because
sure is.
There's so much pressure to produce, but you have to provide that opportunity to fail or take the risk with a chance of potential failure to get the big gains. And to me, that is what separates leadership from just management. having that desire and ability to provide a safe environment for these type of things. And, you know, I try and do that with my staff. I want them to be able to throw out ideas. My mantra when I go and I talk to students is there are no dumb questions, only dumb answers. Don't be afraid to ask a question and demand good answers.
That's a really important point. And unfortunately, it's probably all too rare to have a management and leadership environment like that. Yeah, I really appreciate your perspective on this and also keeping things in a language that people can understand. I mean, even for myself, I'm an engineer, but I'm mechanical and still kind of learning about all this and having you be able to clarify things in language that anybody can understand is really, really important.
Oh, no, it is. I deal with that a lot because, you know, in my position now, I have to explain things, you know, congressmen or staffers understand. And we're, you know, I always look at that as a learning experience or a teaching experience, you know, because they change all the time and you have to explain things, one, so they understand the issue and the importance of an issue, but they have to be able to grasp the relative importance of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you once again. I really appreciate your time here. And Forest Master says hi back, by the way. Yeah, got to connect in between the last time we talked. So,
yeah, Forest is a good buddy. He's a good
friend. He is a great guy. Appreciate your time here and hope you have a great day and happy Thanksgiving.
You too, Dan. Pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise. Take care. Thanks for listening to today's episode of Design Safe Radio. This show is sponsored by the National Science Foundation and NARI. You can subscribe to Design Safe Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you find your podcasts. Please leave us a review so that we can...